The 2020 race for ad dollars is heating up as YouTube tries to compete with local TV and Facebook.
One attendee who I spoke with said the message was, quote, spend as much money with us as possible and it'll go far.
And Hong Kong drops its bid for the London Stock Exchange.
Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing's bid for the London Stock Exchange was always a bit of a long shot, really.
Plus, the U.S. adds 28 Chinese firms to an export blacklist. We'll have the reason why. This is What's News from The Wall Street Journal. I'm Kim Gittleson. Let's get started. Now, before we take a closer look at what YouTube is doing to attract more political ad spending, here's what you missed. Late yesterday, the U.S. added 28 Chinese firms, including video surveillance and facial recognition companies, to an export blacklist. The Commerce Department cited their role in Beijing's repression of Muslim minorities in northwest China. From Hong Kong, Dan Strumpf has more.
So the U.S. is moving to take action against these companies for allegedly their involvement in the repression of the Uyghur minority in China's Xinjiang region in northwest China. Most of the 28 entities that have been added to the list are sort of government entities of one sort or another, typically public security bureaus in different cities around Xinjiang.
Jess says the case could pose a challenge to conservative legal thinking, which has tended to focus on two intertwined ideas. The first one is originalism, which says that laws should be based on the original public meaning of what a provision of the Constitution meant. And the other is textualism. That means focusing on the text of the law rather than what legislators may have had in mind when they wrote it. Here's Jess again.
Most of the companies that have been named in the blacklisting have come out with statements of one sort or another expressing disappointment, and several have been sort of distancing themselves from the work that they did in Xinjiang. For example, SenseTime admits to being involved in two joint ventures involving public security in Xinjiang, but the company says that they sold out of those joint ventures last year and has no involvement in Xinjiang whatsoever. So pretty broadly, there's a sort of sense of disappointment from these companies in the U.S. government's decision. Now, whether it affects them beyond a symbolic level kind of remains to be seen.
Now, this all comes ahead of trade talks, which are set to resume in Washington later this week. President Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said he thought the, quote, mood music between the U.S. and China was improving.
The statements coming out of Beijing have been a little more positive. Seems like the mood music has improved. I don't want to predict outcomes. All these decisions are subject to what President Trump wants to do. But we are open to various ideas, and let's see what they bring.
We reported last week that U.S. soybean prices, which have been badly hit as a result of Chinese tariffs on U.S. exports, have started to recover. That came after China resumed purchases of the crop ahead of the talks this week. And the union representing pilots for Southwest Airlines sued Boeing yesterday. The reason? It all has to do with the 737 MAX. The union says that Boeing rushed the plane to the market and misrepresented it as safe. The nearly 10,000 Southwest pilots represented by the union say they're losing millions of dollars a month as the grounding drags on. Boeing said that while it respects Southwest's pilots and will continue to work with them, it also defended itself against the suit, which it called meritless. Now, our main story this morning. It all has to do with the 2020 presidential race and the millions of ad dollars that will be spent in the run-up to it. We report today that Google's YouTube is stepping up its efforts to compete against Facebook and local TV to get that ad money. J.R. Whalen has been finding out more from Emily Glazer.
So, Emily, YouTube is expected to take in about $11.4 billion in global ad revenue this year. That's a 20% increase from a year earlier. How big of a player was YouTube in the 2016 election?
You know, YouTube played a pretty big role in 2016. Tech for Campaigns, a progressive nonprofit that measured political ad spend found that around $60 million was spent on Google. But overall, TV has still been king in political elections. And we wrote this article because we've been hearing so much about how YouTube especially has been making very specific efforts in the last year or so to capture more of those dollars as the 2020 campaigning spend heats up.
You know, local TV ads, they command about $5 billion a year as opposed to online and digital ads at about $3 billion. But YouTube offers buyers something that local TV does not.
That's true, that you can get a lot more targeted with the audiences on YouTube. With TV, there are certain states that if you want to get in that market, you could even be targeting people in different states or cities that are irrelevant and then spending all this money. Boston is a great example of that if you want to get into New Hampshire, for instance. But YouTube has a lot more specific targeting. And there's a new tool that launched about a month ago, this instant reserve effort that's an automated way to reserve ad slots on YouTube. That was far earlier than ever before as well. So it really allowed a lot of media buyers to try to lock in reservations as far ahead as the end of February. And it's a really key time because the four early voting states happen throughout February for the various nominating contests.
And during the 2018 midterm election season, that targeting generated valuable research that gave ad buyers incredibly specific data on voters under some really interesting categories that went far beyond people's ages, marital status, their jobs, or even their party affiliation.
Indeed. So one of the reasons or ways that Google was trying to capture more of these ad dollars happened right before the 2018 midterm elections. Our understanding, according to a person familiar with the matter, is that Google hired Democrat and Republican digital consultants and pollsters to analyze YouTube's targeting of different demographic segments or affinity groups. One of my favorite ones that we saw with documents that we reviewed that they shared with large buyers, just weeks before the 2018 election, had different groups showing, you know, folks who lean left, folks who lean right, and then persuadable voters. So really that key target in the middle. And some of my favorite ones is listed underneath that were bargain hunters and 30-minute chefs. So they got pretty granular in terms of what types of people media buyers should be targeting, especially as they try to get those swing voters that can be key in elections.
You got to get those efficient chefs to the polls.
Indeed.
How has YouTube changed its ad sales model for the 2020 election?
Good question. We know they just want a lot more. You know, we know in December 2018, so this was right after the midterms, they convened around 200 big Democrat and Republican political consultants in Washington to further prove their effectiveness. And one attendee who I spoke with said the message was, quote, spend as much money with us as possible and it'll go far. So we don't know exactly what kind of projections they have, and Google and YouTube do not release a lot of specifics on their own metrics, but we do know that they're certainly gearing up to get a lot more of that spending in.
What was the response when the tool debuted last month?
Well, people had to wake up very early because it was opening anywhere between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. And that was according to an email that Google sent out to buyers that we reviewed. So I think people, you know, begrudgingly woke up very early and had to get their computers ready to lock in reservations. And a lot of the efforts were focused on these early four voting states, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. So a lot of it was lock in, get those slots, and then keep following it.
A Google spokesperson told us that political ads are subject to additional scrutiny from verifying the buyer's identity to embedding a disclosure in the spot stating who paid for the ad. You can find Emily's full story with Patience Hagen up on WSJ.com. On to markets. Hong Kong Stock Exchange has dropped its nearly $37 billion bid for its London rival. From Hong Kong, Quentin Webb explains.
Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing had this bold and rather surprising idea that by combining with the London Stock Exchange, they could create this sort of cross-continental exchanges group. It was an unsolicited surprise bid, and it didn't really have the support of the target. The board of London Stock Exchange quickly rejected it and said they preferred their plan A, which was a tie-up with Refinitiv, a big financial data company. It never kind of offered Hong Kong Exchange the opportunity to engage in detail on the transaction. And so after a month or so, HKX has actually said, okay, fine, we'll walk away from this. Where does it leave the two? Well, LSE will continue to pursue its transaction with Refinitiv, and HKX will have to think about other ways in which it can continue to grow and to link China to the world's markets.
And here's what else we're paying attention to today. The Supreme Court will consider several cases testing whether gay or transgender employees are protected under the Civil Rights Act of 1964's prohibition of sex discrimination. Our legal reporter Jess Bravin has more from outside the court in Washington.
Gerald Bostock and Donald Zarda are the two men in separate cases, but they've been consolidated at the Supreme Court because the issue is the same. And the issue is whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII of that act, which prohibits employment discrimination on the basis of sex, among other categories, applies to sexual orientation. And lower courts have been divided on that question.
Jess says the case could pose a challenge to conservative legal thinking, which has tended to focus on two intertwined ideas. The first one is originalism, which says that laws should be based on the original public meaning of what a provision of the Constitution meant. And the other is textualism. That means focusing on the text of the law rather than what legislatures may have had in mind when they wrote it. Here's Jess again.
Here we see a potential for those to point in opposite directions. Certainly in 1964, when President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, few people were thinking of extending legal protections to gay and lesbian employees. In fact, at the time, the American Psychiatric Association considered homosexuality to be a mental disorder, and sodomy laws were on the books, perhaps in most states in the country. Obviously, that's no longer true today, but that was what was in mind then. On the other hand, the word they used, the word that Congress used in enacting the statute was discrimination based on sex. It didn't say based on sexual norms of the mid-20th century or anything like that. It was a very broad term.
This is the first major gay rights issue to reach the justices since their landmark decision in 2015 extending marriage rights to same-sex couples. Finally, new court filings in the pay case between U.S. women's soccer players and the U.S. Soccer Federation. They revealed just how much the top female players get paid. Megan Rapinoe, Carly Lloyd, Alex Morgan, and Becky Sauerbrunn each earned a total of $1.1 to $1.2 million for their national team play between March 30, 2014 and September 30, 2019. The U.S. Soccer Federation says that each of them earned more than the highest paid male soccer player during that period. But the women counter that they played more games and won more of them during that time. 83% of the women's games were won compared to 48% for the men. The reason that matters? Well, the women say that if they had been subject to the men's team's collective bargaining agreement during that time, they would have each earned at least $2.5 million more. That's what's news from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.